Good evening, good afternoon, across the fruited plains of the United States from coast to coast. Welcome to this special edition of Narsil in Action. Due to Narsil's recent national conference, which followed by my own vacation, it's been 2 months since we've had a conference call. And it's really gratifying that we have well over 115 signed up for tonight. I think we're pushing 120. We would welcome any assistance in planning and promoting future calls, so please contact us if you're interested in program content or maybe even hosting one of these productions. Andy, welcome, my co-host from Registry Matters Podcast. You'll be assisting us tonight with production and responsible for making everything run smoothly. And thank you for all your hours and hours of preparation to get this set up. During the first hour tonight, we'll be discussing an upcoming challenge in Georgia that Narsil is assisting with. And the challenge has to do with two sheriffs who've decided to unilaterally impose their own sign requirements to those within their jurisdictions. Our special guest for that hour will be Mark Yurecek, who's leading the team. He'll be assisted by another Mark, Begnaud, and then our attorney out of Chapel Hill, Paul Dubing, will be consulting. Hour two will focus on the recently enacted law in Tennessee, which would have forced registrants to leave their homes had it not been blocked by a federal judge due to some very, very brilliant lawyering on short notice. And we'll have Patrick McNally with us for that segment. Mr. McNally is one of the four attorneys working on the lawsuit. And the third hour will focus on some exciting news from New Mexico. The guest will be Ashley Cloud, and Ms. Cloud will be likely become the staff attorney for our New Mexico affiliate, Liberty and Justice Coalition. And Ms. Cloud will provide an overview of the Liberty and Justice Coalition's litigation priorities and take some of your questions. So as we say from time to time, probably nobody's going to stay on for the whole 3 hours, but you can drift in and out when you have an interest in a particular segment. And we plan to award some prizes to keep you tuned in at various points during the call. So I doubt there'll be it in the first hour. So you have to be here at least on the second or third hour. If you would like to enter the drawing, you can send a text so that you'll be given a contestant number. And the number is 747-227-4477. And just hit at the text and say prize, and our lovely producer will send you a contestant number, and we will draw a couple of numbers later in the program. So that's 747-227-4477. And the prizes are a $50 gift card of your choice, or you can attend the 2020 conference, which is going to be in Raleigh for no registration. So now it's time to introduce our special guest for the first hour. Let me introduce Mark Yurecek, who will be with us for this hour, and hopefully he can get out of here a few minutes early because he's got another engagement. Mark has been a licensed attorney in Georgia and Virginia since 2000. For the past 15 years, he's been the managing partner of Mark Allen Yurecek and Associates in Atlanta and Falls Church, Virginia. Mark's work focuses on criminal defense and particularly post-conviction and appellate matters. He practices all over the country, in particular in the southeastern United States. He recently argued and won Park versus State, a case that held that Georgia's GPS monitoring for sex offenders was unconstitutional. He continues to consult and advocate for sex offenders among his clients all over the country. Mark, welcome, and thank you for joining us, and I've had the privilege of meeting you.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry. I appreciate it.
I got to tell a little story about. I like to poke fun of myself. So when I was trying to set up a meeting with Mark, there was a distance of significant between the two of us on the day we wanted to meet. And if anybody's been to Atlanta Metro, it's a heck of a mess, particularly around rush hour. It doesn't matter which direction you're going, southeast, north, or west, it's jammed up. And so we agreed to meet halfway between and pick this location in Stockbridge. And so his office assistant was setting up the location, and she and I were talking about it. And she says, "Well, where do you want to meet?" And I said, "Well, we'll meet at the Chick-fil-A on 138, which they built in 1995." And she says, "Well, I'm looking and I don't see a Chick-fil-A on 138. And I said, well, it's been up there for all these years. I don't know why you can't see it. I said, well, just tell him to go down I-75 and get off at 138, turn left, and he'll see the Chick-fil-A. And of course, I hadn't been to the Chick-fil-A on this particular trip, and the Chick-fil-A was no longer there. So she says, well, if you say so. And I said, well, I say so. It's been there since 1995. Chick-fil-A in a state down. And I drive up to the Chick-fil-A because there's no signage and there's no Chick-fil-A there. So I think she actually knew something I didn't know, that there was no Chick-fil-A there. So that was my humorous story for getting to meet you. We had to meet next door at the IHOP. So Mark,
well, thankfully there's no shortage of fast food in that part of the world. So.
Did she tell me about how adamant I was saying that? I said, just tell him to get off at 138 and left. I said, he can't miss it. So, on the case of Park versus State, we're not going to spend a lot of time here on Mr. Park, but it's just to show the quality of the lawyering and the cause itself. So tell us a little bit about Park and what would have been required had it not been for your successful challenge.
Well, like a majority of the states in the country these days, Georgia at least had a law which authorized a board that was governor appointed to make an assessment of people who are already registrants on the Georgia Sex Offender Registry. The assessment is pretty much in line with what the rest of the country did in terms of classifying offenders into three different groups as in terms of risk to reoffend. The classification system, as a side note, is a pretty willy-nilly process, and I'm in the middle of actually a vagueness challenge to that, which had been up to the Georgia Supreme Court and got remanded because of Park. And I feel like we'll have a pretty good dust up with that case when it gets back to the Supreme Court. We're sending in our application for discretionary review to that on Friday. Beside that point, what we argued in Mr. Park's case was that the ankle monitoring, lifetime ankle monitoring that the statute authorized for offenders who were found to be in the highest risk category was unconstitutional on a number of grounds. The monitoring program authorized, as I said, in fact, and required monitoring for life. And in addition, the lifetime monitoring would be done at the offender's expense. And there was a moment in my argument in the Supreme Court that I will remember for a while. It was when the rather rubber-faced, and I say that good-naturedly, Solicitor General for the state of Georgia, who was like the third solicitor to have the job in about a year and a half, because the first two got appointed to the Georgia Supreme Court, the very young Solicitor General for the state, was arguing about the money that offenders were going to be required to pay for the rest of their life so that they could have the privilege of being monitored 24/7. And one of the sharper justices on the court, Justice David Namias, who graduated second in his class at Harvard Law School to a fellow named Obama. Justice Namias asks this question of the solicitor, and the question was this: so you're saying that an offender will be required to pay for himself to be searched? And of course, the solicitor acknowledged that's correct. And he said, what do you think the founders would have thought about that? And the poor guy just, I mean, I've been in that situation plenty of times in appeals where there's just not much to say. And there wasn't much for him to say. It was a poorly, poorly written law. So ultimately what the Supreme Court found was that for that reason and for several others, including the fact that registrants were not even able to ask off of the monitoring requirement after it was assessed, you were there for life if you didn't win your initial challenge to it. What the Supreme Court found was that constituted an unreasonable search, and the court's ruling was in line with, for instance, the string of appellate court cases that have come out of North Carolina in the last year and a half, subsequent to Grady, and also a case out of New Jersey that just occurred maybe about 6 months ago, and I'm sorry, the name escapes me. But the court's basic position was that if you are someone who is off probation and off parole, then the state has no right to inflict ankle monitoring on you for the rest of your life because it's an unlawful search. Now, they left the door open for monitoring to be part of a scheme where it was, you know, for offenders who were still on probation or parole. But, you know, in my opinion, that itself constitutes a pretty big win, because the other thing that Georgia didn't do and the other thing that most states don't do is that they don't afford a lot of due process protections for the registrants who are being made to do this. And so when Georgia says, hey, look, you can do this maybe as part of probation parole, then my thought on that is that, you know, if you're going to have the law, that's the way to do it, because they're getting their due process. And especially if you make it part of a sentencing scheme, then, you know, they'll have counsel, they'll have, you know, the potential of things such as subpoenaing witness and so on and so forth that currently Georgia's system and a lot of state systems don't have. So I thought that was a pretty good win. And I think that's a case that may get looked at other places. I hope so. For the purpose of determining how these monitoring statutes really should work. So, I mean, Georgia found a lot of problems with that case with regard to Mr. Park. You know, I was thankful. You know, the Georgia Supreme Court is a fairly conservative bunch, but the one thing that I will say about this current crop is that they are very smart as well, and so they tend to they'll gravitate towards smart arguments and sharp arguments. So I really appreciated the fact that they were open to those arguments. And like I said, I'm hoping we come back with this next case for my client, Mr. Walker. And just knock the whole statute out and make them go back to the drawing board. So that's probably a more detailed description than you probably needed, but that's the nuts and bolts of what happened in Mr. Park's case.
I think it's a great explanation, because people out there are listening, are not just in Georgia, they're listening all over the country, and they're going to want to know how this can transfer to their jurisdiction. And in fact, we're inspired by it in New Mexico, and on the third hour, we're going to be talking about our litigation priorities, and we've got within our post-prison supervision model, we have what they call parole, but it's really a post-prison period of supervision after you serve all your prison time. And it's required by statute for the entire duration, real-time GPS monitoring. So we were inspired by, you just put that in the statute in the New Jersey case, which I can't remember, that there's a body of case law building, and we're going to build on your case. So I think it's great to have people around the country hearing that just blanket applying GPS monitoring to everybody is very problematic, because it's a search and it's a seizure. And the Supreme Court's already made that clear.
I think the other thing is that if we can, you know, what's implicit in the findings that was not explicitly made, but what's implicit is that that the monitoring provision really sort of amounts more to a punishment than it does than it does a excuse me than it does a civil regulation, as of course we know courts have found the registries to be over and over again. So I'm thankful that that's sort of the direction it's going, because, you know, the other thing is that the door gets open for us to argue that, you know, this is a cruel and unusual punishment in certain instances, if not most instances. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of fighting to be done over this still. And, you know, of course, it's unfortunately, you know, I haven't been on a lot of these calls, these discussions, but I'm quite certain that, you know, it's not the first time it's been said that this is by far or very much one of the most vulnerable classes of people out there in terms of what can be done to them with legislation, because of the fact that there's very little sympathy in the public for what's going on. So, you know, Georgia, I think, is a great example of a state that's just going to take its whacks at sex offenders and see what sticks. And so, you know, there has to be a very aggressive fight back in the courts at anything that gets done like this. So, like I said, I really am thankful that Mr. Park's case came along and that we were able to get a good result out of it.
Well, and we're thankful that Mr. Park introduced us and Arsenal to you, because as the point of our conversation
tonight. I would not
tonight,
be surprised at all if Mr. Park were on this call.
He is here.
Have a minute. My former client, Michael Young, is definitely on this call, and I just wanted to acknowledge that and say that, you know, I'm really happy to say that we were able to get a sentence for Mr. Young reduced down so that he's now breathing free air, and as I understand it, either married or engaged. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to advance the relationship further than it is. But I know Mike's on this call, and I just want to just acknowledge that and thank him for being here.
And we're grateful for the relationship that we've formulated in Arsenal. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. We became aware the day before Halloween in 2018 that two counties in Georgia, which Georgia has 159, for those who don't know, it's the largest state and county, a number of counties except for Texas. And the counties of Butts and the county of Spalding, which they're both really essentially metro counties to the south of Atlanta, they decided that their sheriffs were going to arbitrarily, unilaterally require offenders to post signs. I think Spalding provided the signs, and I think that Butts, if I understand correctly, and we'll get some input from Georgians, I think Butts actually had their own signs, and they erected them themselves. But we sent cautionary letters to the sheriffs and the county attorneys explaining them that we could not unearth any statutory authority, whether it was constitutional or not. We could not unearth any statutory authority that provided for the erection of signs and the compelled speaking of a message. And we encouraged them not to do that, and they ignored us, and they put the signs up. And so after we became acquainted with Mr. Juracek, we explored, would this be something that we could possibly litigate with any reasonable chance of success? And fortunately, we've come up with what we think are some causes of action, and we're working on putting together a lawsuit. So tell us briefly about the issues that we plan to litigate, what our cause of action might be, because we don't have the complaint filed yet. We haven't identified plaintiffs, and we're hoping there's somebody in Butts or Spalding County listening tonight that will step forward when we take phone calls. But right now, we have not identified by plaintiffs.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Sure, and the one thing to remember, of course, is that you know, facts often determine the issues. And so once we have sat down and identified a couple plaintiffs, the issue or issues may, you know, vary. But what Mark Bednode and I have identified initially are two primary vehicles for going forward, those being what Larry mentioned, the compelled speech issue, in terms of forcing someone to erect a sign, disclosing, you know, matters, whether public or private, on their own, in their own home. So that would be the first issue. And as Larry said, there's not a lot out there about compelled speech, but there is, I think, a little bit. And what's out there is that it's pretty restrictive. I mean, we can all agree that state-compelled speech is a pretty dangerous thing, forcing people to disclose things, even if it's otherwise public information, as this obviously is, would certainly run counter to many First Amendment principles. Mark and I are still discussing the other issues, but the other one that stands out is the one that Larry knows that I'm kind of married to, and that is the issue of a trespass, a physical trespass onto the property of the registrant. The reason we would come up with that concept is that I've stepped into my car. Can everybody still hear me?
At the moment, we can, yes.
Oh, did I lose you for a second? Sorry about that. Just had to step into my car. So anyway, what I was about to say was that the other issue that we came up with was one that relates to trespass. That being that physically, these people are being compelled to put signs on their yards, which are, of course, their property. And it's a government trespass, which, you know, I mean, even if it's for whatever, a 2x2 square inch area is a trespass upon the yard. And for that matter, it also, at least conceptually, could amount to a taking in the same way that, for instance, the cable company comes and runs cable through your yard and so on and so forth. It's basically an easement. So there's some property issues there too, which, you know, it's always nice to throw a curveball in case you get a very nerdy judge who likes that kind of stuff and isn't so much for the nuts and bolts stuff. But, you know, we are certainly still going through and investigating and trying to learn exactly how everything functions. And depending on how that works, like I said, the facts are going to be very determinative of what ultimately gets done. So that's kind of where we are.
Are you going to take this action into state or federal court? I already know the answer, but the listeners don't.
Right. Oh, sorry. The plan, the agreed upon plan for now, is to take the case into federal court. Our preference being the U.S. District Court, Northern District of Georgia, which is seated in Atlanta. I believe one of the counties, and we keep getting them crossed up. But basically, the one of the counties is in the Northern District of Georgia. The other one is in the Middle District of Georgia, which is seated in Macon, Georgia. By and large, the Northern District is populated with some more favorable judges because a lot of the Northern District's judges have retired in the last 10 years. And it turns out there were quite a few Obama appointees that wound up there. So we get a little bit more favorable run in the Northern District than we do in the middle. Although, you know, if we had to go to the middle, we feel like the issues are strong enough that we're not really going to we're not going to be dead meat or anything like that. And ultimately, all of this is probably headed to the 11th Circuit anyway. The district court matters as it always does, but it's all the 11th Circuit anyway. So that's the crux of the where we are thinking to go right now.
Can you briefly illuminate Georgia, like many states, elects their judges, and the federal judges have the insulation. Can you illuminate how important that is for our listeners that we remove a lot of the political pressure from the electorate when you're in Article III situation?
I don't suspect any of the judges, the Superior Court judges in Spalding or Butts, and that's in Georgia, it would go through the Superior Courts. I don't imagine there's any judge in Spalding or Butts that would give us the time of day with this kind of action. Ultimately, this is something that probably would get to
the Georgia Supreme Court, and I've just sung their praises, but certainly they are a conservative bunch. I don't mean to act like, we're dealing with shades of the Warren Court or anything like that up there. With regard to the federal courts in Georgia, they tend to be conservative for sure, but, the judges, especially in the Northern District right now, are not terrible. They've been, in my mind, they've been subject to a lot of criticism, in the past years, but it's gotten much better and much more progressive over the last few years. And there's a couple that I'd actually really look forward to presiding over a case that I had. So that part, I'm not counting on getting one of them. But at the same time, I think we'll get a fair run in the Northern District, which is kind of all you can ask for, I'd say.
Well, plaintiff's selection, it'll be really illuminated in the second hour when we're talking about the Tennessee, because they did a marvelous job. But can you talk a little bit about the importance of the selection of plaintiffs, because how it can impact the trajectory of the litigation? Because people would sometimes say, well, I'm willing to be a plaintiff, and sometimes they're not ideal or not even worthy of the type of challenge, because we're going to be sunk just on their facts alone. So let's talk about plaintiff selection, how important that is.
Okay. Well, obviously the plaintiff selection, all of this starts with who we're representing and, what their life story is. That's a part of this, whether we want it to be or not. So, obviously when we're out there, what we're hoping for is the guy that, when he was 20 years old, had the 15-year-old girlfriend, got convicted of stat rape, is a sex offender, and, now is married to the woman he, long time ago, had sex with. Okay. That's for lack of a better term, it's a dream scenario in what we're doing. It's not likely to happen. But, we're also going to have to sort of pick out people on the other side who, for instance, have multiple violations and so on and so forth, and might be viewed by a court as some very dangerous people. We also, we need to look out for people who, consistent with what we were talking about with Mr. Park, people who are not on probation or parole, because those people are closer to being under the government's thumb. That's another thing that we have to look out for. So it's going to have to be somebody closer to that first guy I mentioned, or woman I mentioned, as opposed to someone on the other end of the spectrum. Now, whether or not that person is out there is not something we really know at this point, but we're hopeful.
That is correct. Now, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Were you need to continue?
No, you got it. What?
Okay. All right. Okay. Everybody wants to know about the progression of the case. And I try to stress there are no instant decisions. The only instant decision we would get would be if we seek a temporary restraining order. But generally speaking, a federal civil rights action is going to progress at what pace? Because we will get dozens of calls and emails saying, well, what's happening on the case? Well, can you tell us how the case progresses once we do the preliminary filing and whether or not we're granted injunctive relief on the front end? This case is going to be going for what period of time?
Yeah, and I wish I had Mark here to expound on that a little bit more, because he's the guy that does a lot of Section 1983 litigation, which is the code section that we're proceeding under. But generally speaking, you're right. The first thing is going to be the fight over a preliminary injunction. And honestly, a lot of the fighting might be done right then and there, just in order to be able to show the likelihood of success on the merits of the case and all that, and having the court make a determination there. It's likely that the party losing the injunction, losing the injunction motion, is going to want to appeal it right then and there to the 11th Circuit, And at that point, we'll have a pretty good idea of where the 11th Circuit stands on the situation, I would guess. That could mean that this litigation, it's not going to go lightning fast. And frankly, we're running out of time if we really want to get something in place by Halloween. So, you know, I mean, that's something. I mean, we have a letter that we've prepared in terms of, you know, recruiting clients and alerting the public that this is something that we're going to do. And that letter I expect to go out probably tomorrow or beginning of next week. So once that's done, we'll hopefully start getting some calls from people and without much delay, start interviewing people and figuring out, you know, where our plaintiff is going to come from. So, you know, that's the next step. You know, once we figure out who our plaintiff is, we're not going to hesitate. Well, I mean, the lawsuit, frankly, is going to be written, and we just need to fill in names and a few other key facts. And once that gets done, we're off to the races. In this kind of case, a lot of the arguing and the fighting will go on right from the start, and there's not going to be this long back and forth. There may be some discovery and all, but a lot of the arguments here are going to, well, I mean, it's not totally true. There will be some factual-based arguments here, but a lot of it's just going to be whether or not the sheriffs are exceeding their authority in terms of what they're doing here. So that's really, you know, that's really something that has a lot to do with legal analysis and not a lot to do with factual, although we're going to have to establish factually what they were doing and when they were doing it. So there won't be no discovery either. So time frame wise, you know, what our hope is that we can get something filed, get a response, and hopefully get to the fighting before Halloween, and so that we have kind of know where we stand. And, you know, in a perfect world, even get a ruling on an injunction that hopefully gets granted, and then they've got to deal with appealing it while the injunction's in place. So, you know, that's, you know, time frame wise, it's always hard to sort of predict when you're talking about, you know, litigation, busy courts, and so on and so forth. But that's our goal.
Oh, well, you can make any comments before we take audience questions, and we're gonna do a switch in our platform. But do you have anything you want to observe before we take questions? And we're gonna give priority to people in Georgia. So
no, you know, I really appreciate that. You know, there's 115 people listening to this call, and for everybody to have just been bored out of their minds with the last 30 minutes or so of me talking. So if anyone's still awake, I'm happy to answer any questions. I would certainly like to hear from Mr. Young if he is on this call. So that's it.
So when we switch to the question mode, everybody gets muted, including you and our bridge connection. So we have to take a few moments to get everybody that we want speaking back live. So everybody be patient as we make the switch.
Q&A session has started. Unmuted.
So now, Andy, if you could help me find MAK. And anybody, while Andy is looking for MAK, you can hit star 6, and we will take you, and we found MAY, not MAK. So star 6 will get you in the queue to ask questions. And please, if you have a connection to Georgia, we want to give priority to Georgia because it might help us find a plaintiff tonight, and that would save us hundreds of dollars in search and time fees. So I see the first one up is Phoenix. So I'm going to skip you for the moment, and we're going to try to get Georgia, but I will come back to everybody if we have time. So, okay. So star 6 will get you in the queue. And try to ask a question about this particular litigation. So you're on Narsil in Action, area code 352. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Mike Young. How are you, Mark?
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, sir. And that wonderful woman that found you for me is now my wife and my business partner.
Well, tell Jan I said hello as well.
I will. She's listening also. Hey, question I have for you, sir, on Halloween. I'm an interstate compact, Georgia State convicted sex offender living in Florida.
Yes.
Would anything that you do GPS or Halloween posting wise help me in Florida, because I live under very similar requirements? I'm a low risk sex offender that is required to wear a GPS monitor for the rest of my life.
Okay, well, so I mean, yeah, it seems to me that potentially, you know, any of the GPS stuff, I think, is fair game. Because I mean, seriously, I've had to review in attacking Georgia's statute. I reviewed most states that really sort of stuck out in terms of their monitoring requirements and all that. And I've found flaws in just about all of them. And I mean, without being too obvious, I'm itching for the fight. Just about any other place that'll have me in terms of attacking the GPS requirement. Now, I'm surprised that you're considered a low-level risk, but still subject to ankle monitoring. And there are probably some facts and details about your case that I know, and I don't really care to discuss them in a public forum. But what I would say is that it surprises me that Florida would tell you, one, that you're low risk, but two, that you're subject to ankle monitoring for life. I'm not well-versed in Florida's statute, so I don't want to say, you know, for sure or anything like that, but you know, if they're going to make you be on for life, then, you know, for instance, what Georgia said was you got to be able to have some kind of an escape hatch somewhere down the line in case circumstances change and so on and so forth. One of the questions I remember being posed in Georgia when I argued that case, when I argued Mr. Park's case, by the way, I would not doubt for a minute that Joseph Park is on this call as well.
Yes.
But, you know, one thing that stuck out to me in the argument was that one of the justices, Justice Benham in the Supreme Court, asked me what would happen if someone was in a PVS, persistent vegetative state. Would they still be required to wear the ankle monitor in Georgia? The answer is yes. And so that was something that just concerned them as well. There's just if there's no out, then that, what that ends up doing is amounting to being a denial of due process for the registrant. So what you have to look at is, you know, what are the circumstances of Florida committed you to monitoring? Was it just because you were in a state compact? Was it something about the facts of your case? Was it just because everybody who's committed, you know, X crime or convicted of X crime and or similar crimes from other states, as far as your cases go? You know, are they automatically on? Is there some way to appeal it? Is there some kind of hearing in front of a neutral tribunal? You know, all of those things need to come into play in order for it to comport with your constitutional rights, and about 100 other things too.
Right.
You know, what ended up happening with this is it's a punishment, whether they want to call it a punishment or not. It's a punishment, and what they're doing is having these de facto trials. And a lot of times, it's not done with a judge. It's not, certainly not done with a jury. You know, Wisconsin's the only place I can think of where you might get a jury. You know, it's not done with certain rights that go along with the risk of punishment, like an attorney, like, you know, like subpoenaing witnesses and so on and so forth. So if they don't have all of those things, then I think the laws are vulnerable and they're subject to attack. So. So suffice to say, Mike, you've got my phone number. So maybe we should speak some other time about the specifics of your situation. And I welcome anybody actually to give me a call if they want, and I'll give my phone number out.
We're gonna let you. We're gonna let you give that out. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll let you get that out. And I'll be happy. I'm also a consultant on Interstate Compact. I'll be happy to reach out to Mike and talk about this. But I want to try to move along because hopefully we can find somebody who's affected by this. But thank you. Thank you, Mr. Young.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to hear your voice, man.
Okay, so *6 will get you in the queue, and I'm going to try to pick up the pace a little bit. The next person, area code 505. That's not Georgia. You're on Arsenal in Action.
It's New Mexico. Thank you. Yeah. Real quickly, what would happen if, since the sheriffs have no statutory authority, what would happen if people just remove the signs?
Well, that's a good question. my guess is that the sheriffs are going to find some kind of criminal punishment for the removal, e.g. failure to register would be like the blanket
or defacing
thing
that
you might throw out there.
The truth is,
to answer your question directly, there's no crime that they're committing by not putting the signs up, but if they refuse to put up the signs, depending on the circumstances, I guarantee you that the sheriffs in those counties are going to find something to arrest them for.
It'd be like defacing property.
Correct, but that would be fodder for a court case, too, and I'll leave it with that.
Well, sure. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
for
you.
Sure.
We
don't want anyone having to get arrested to go through this process. That's the entire point of, for instance, a declaratory judgment action, which is essentially what we're going to be doing in this case in Northern District of Georgia. Yes, absolutely. I think that would be fodder if someone got arrested, but we don't want all y'all going out there and getting yourselves arrested if you don't have to. That's kind of the goal here. So,
of course, civil disobedience is an option.
It is.
Well, I'm not advising that, and let me be real clear about that one. I am not advising that. I don't think it's a great idea, but obviously, if someone gets caught up in a situation, I think it's fair to say that we would be quick to defend someone in that situation.
Thank you. I'll go away now.
Thank you, and I hope you're on the third hour with us. Okay, anybody who wants to get into the queue, it's dropped off to only two. So *6, and we'll get you in the queue. So area code 810, you're on Narsil in Action with Mark Juracek.
Mark, I just want to tell you thank you so much for what y'all are doing. I moved to Pennsylvania from Michigan, and Michigan had that tethering. What happens when a person moves from one state? Because I have a friend who might come to live with me after they're off parole. Wasn't sure how that works. But also, what happens when a person in any state becomes to the point where we're all getting older. I just hit the big 5-0. What happens when you get to the point you can't get around or you can't remember that you're supposed to register and stuff like that?
Well, I'm best versed in Georgia's laws, so forgive me for defaulting to those.
No, I'm sorry.
In Georgia, in terms of registration, okay, there are exceptions to the law. There are escape hatches in terms of registration for people who are disabled, permanently disabled, per that definition in Georgia code, those kinds of situations. And so if you did have somebody who was getting older and, for instance, was suffering from dementia or bedridden or something like that, at least where I am, there are provisions to get out. And I'm pretty familiar with a lot of states, and that situation seems like it's pretty consistent throughout the country. Now, you asked about what happens when you come in from another state. And interestingly, I've come across a case in Pennsylvania which dealt with Pennsylvania's law. Most states will say that people have to register. There's an automatic registration requirement just about every statute that says that if you have to register in one place, you have to register in our place too. Then there's also provisions where if you've committed X crime or it's equivalent in another state, then that too gets you signed up. Now, I'm involved in some litigation right now, about a statute like that. And the argument we've made is that when one comes from one state to another and there's just a determination made by the by some sheriff or something like that that the person has to register, that they've kind of skipped a step because there's no legal analysis as to comparing apples to apples. I believe the Alaska Supreme Court just had a case come out about that and said that was a denial of due process. So, that gives me some hope that might be another frontier where you're talking about people who have moved from one state to another, perhaps have committed a fairly minor crime in one place, and then are going to, you know, be made to register another, which is just, you know, kind of bogus. You know, it may have been borderline that they even should have registered in the first place. So, you know, I mean, on the one hand, if you're moving, it's almost certain that the state you're moving to is going to have some requirement that says if you have to register, or if you have to register in one place, you've got to register here too. On the other hand, I really feel like that those statutes might be, you could get some things done with those statutes in the right situation, I think.
Well, like Michigan has ankle tethering, but they don't have it here in Pennsylvania. Actually, Pennsylvania is not that bad because you can live anywhere. You can live right next door to a school, which tells me, if, you know, those, you know, where you can and can't live laws, if it's not happening here in Pennsylvania, it's not happening in you know, a state like Florida where it's horrible, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What happens to that ankle tether moving from Michigan? Because Pennsylvania doesn't have it.
So I'm gonna move on past
the right
this. We're way off topic here. I appreciate this call, but we're trying to stay on topic about the sheriffs and the signs. So yep. Thank you so much. So and you'll still hear, but I'm gonna mute your mic for a moment. Okay, so we're going to try to zip through these remaining questions and give you time to give out. Why don't you go ahead and give out your contact information now before we take any more calls. If you want to get a hold of Mark,
if anyone's got questions for me, you know, I'm usually pretty happy to answer questions. You know, kind of next couple of days, I might be a little bit out of touch, but you can reach me. My office number is 470-319-8721. That's 470-319-8721, or you can email me at Mark, M-A-R-K, at M-Y, like my initials, appealslawyer.com. That's myappealslawyer.com. It's also my website.
All right. So thank you for that. We're gonna try to zip through these before you have to split. Yeah, star 6 if you're in Georgia especially, but there's a number of people here, and I know that they're not in Georgia, but we're going to take them because they're in the queue. So, Captain, you're on the Narsil in action. Go ahead.
Hello, this is Bob down in Brevard County, Florida. And I just wanted to make a comment concerning the monitoring in Florida for the gentleman who moved from Georgia to Florida. I moved from Virginia to Florida. I did not have the monitor put on me until I'd been here for 6 years. I was released from probation last year, and the day that I was released from probation, they cut the monitor off. So I'm off of probation with no monitor here in Florida. So I don't know.
He's still on supervision. He's still on supervision, Captain. He's still on supervision, though. He's on interstate compact supervision transfer. Yeah. So that's his issue.
Okay, but wearing it for life, I don't think is quite accurate, because as soon as he's off of probation, the monitor will come off.
Well, but if he's got a lifetime or a very long period of probation, then that's the problem. Like if he were to compact from my state to Florida, he would potentially have lifetime supervision, and some other states do that. But yeah, his issue is on the he's under supervision. And I'm going to reach out to him and try to see if we can gather some more facts, because I do a lot of interstate compact work. But and thank you for being at the conference with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right. So quickly, 480 Phoenix, you're on Narsil in action. Question, please.
Hey, good evening. This is Robert. Been a long time Narsil and AZROSL member, and I was convicted in 2004, and in 2017 the state passed a law saying that certain people have to have ankle monitors. My crime fell under that provision, and I kind of felt that was an ex post facto situation. How do states get away with all these ex post facto conditions onto registered citizens?
Great question. And I'm going to answer that in the interest of time, because there's a presumption finality when something's passed, and until there's a challenge, which the challenger has the burden of proving by showing by the clearest of proof that it's not constitutional, they get away with it because we're so ill-funded that we don't have enough money to do the challenges, and these attorneys cannot take on the vast resources of the states and do it pro bono, because it's like these challenges can drag on for years, and often do sometimes drag on for years and devour well over $100,000 in billable hours, sometimes multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars in billable hours. So they get away with it because it's presumed constitutional. But let's try our best to see if we can get some people from Georgia on the next one. You're on Narsil in Action, area code 484.
Hello?
Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Go ahead.
This is Dan from Pennsylvania. Could I just, all I was wanting to do was to, if I could get the address of the attorney, not just the phone number, but I'd like to write him a letter. And I didn't catch the full address.
We'll put that out in an email after the conference call. We'll put out the contact information for the attorneys that are on here, if that works okay for everybody. So thank you, Dan. Thank you so
Sounds
much.
Good. No, thank you.
Star 6 will get you in the queue for the remaining moments, and we have one more call. We are on area code 734. You're on Narsil in Action.
Hi, this is Frank.
Please go ahead.
Am I on?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, okay. I wasn't sure if I was still on mute. This is Frank. I'm in Michigan, and first of all, I just wanted to say my understanding is that they only put you on a tether, an ankle tether here for high-level offenses as far as the state, but the federal district pretty much always does it, and at least until you're adjudicated. Now, as far as Halloween, in our county, I'm in Washtenaw County in Michigan, which is Ann Arbor. And on Halloween, we go into lockup when we were on probation or parole. You go, I have to go in at 2:30 or 3. If you don't, and you stay there until like 9 o'clock. If you don't show up, you get arrested, period. Once you're off of probation, I was just on probation, so I don't know what happens with the parolees, but once you're off probation, you no longer have to do that. I would really hate, because I'm low level, we have a three-tiered system, and I'm only tier one, so which is nonviolent, you know, it's just pornography. So I'd hate to have to put a sign in my front yard and announce to my whole neighborhood that I got in trouble. And I think the whole thing really needs to be shot down, and I wish you guys a lot of luck.
Thank you so much. That is going to be our final call for this segment. We're running up on the clock. Mr. Yurchek, did you have anything? You can give your phone number again. Do you have any closing comments? We've lost Mr. Yurchek. All righty. He's dropped off of the console. So, all right.
Let me ask you a quick question, though, Larry. This came in over YouTube. What happens if you just don't go pick up the sign from the sheriff?
Well, that's what we were discussing. If you don't pick up the sign, in the case of Butts County, I believe they actually erected the signs. But what we were trying to get across is that although there's not a statutory section, there's what's called contempt of cop. And there's no such statute called contempt of cop, but they'll get you for something. And the most thing that comes to most mind would be that if you didn't go pick up the sign, they wouldn't be able to get you for destruction of county property. But what they would probably do would be set some kind of concerted effort to make sure that they find you in violation. Because if you work hard enough, you can generally find someone in violation. But I would imagine that some people, if they just refuse, would probably get away with it. It depends on how vulnerable they perceived you. Sometimes they're smart enough to figure out this is not a fight we want to pick. So it's possible. We don't advise it at Narsil, and neither does Mark. But sometimes standing up, you might very well get away with it.
Gotcha.
So, but we are we are running up on the end of this segment, and we are grateful that we had Mark here. I can give his phone number again if you have it, Mr. Producer. Here it is, 404-441-2262. And we're going to be back. We're going to be back after a 5-minute respite for the second hour. We'll be talking about Tennessee. And you don't want to miss that, because that is really the most important of the 3 hours, in my view, the danger. So you're listening to Narsil in Action.